I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. Welcome to the show. This episode, we're going to do something a little different. We have a special surprise for you. The Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction Conference is coming up, the official mid-year conference of the Society of Addiction Psychology, APA's Division 50. And we're going to have people who've won registration awards present their posters to us in a shortened format. So there'll be seven people joining us to talk about their research and the implications of their research in a condensed format.
Yeah, and we're really excited about this because, you know, these are individuals who won awards for this upcoming conference. And the conference is from March 17th through the 19th. So it's this coming Wednesday through Friday. And there's still time to register. It's $110 for non-members, $90 for members, and $50 for students. So relatively affordable compared to some other conferences. And Dr. George Kube, director of the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, will be joining us for a question and answer session. It's going to be really informative. So if you haven't signed up, go sign up now. And in the interim, we hope you enjoy our conversations with these poster award winners. All right. First, we have Neo Gabru, who is a fourth-year doctoral candidate in health behavior at the University of Florida. He works with Dr. Rob Lehman, and his poster is called "That's Pot Culture Right There: Purchasing Behaviors of Recreational Marijuana Users." Neo, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We're excited to chat with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your project?
Yeah. Thanks for having me today. So research indicates that purchasing behaviors of marijuana are prospectively associated with marijuana use. And as you know, the legal landscape surrounding marijuana use has been rapidly changing in recent years, with considerable portions of the U.S. decriminalizing or legalizing use of both recreational and medicinal marijuana. And that has dramatically increased access to marijuana in recent years. However, little is known about the factors that affect purchase of recreational marijuana. And we think this information might be useful and important for future intervention development and policy efforts that aim to address marijuana misuse. So in this qualitative study, we aim to characterize the purchasing behaviors of individuals who use marijuana recreationally. So we conducted five focus groups with individuals who reported at least once a week marijuana use for the past month, at least weekly for the past 6 months, and reported purchasing marijuana at least twice in the past 6 months. And a total of 31 individuals participated in these focus groups, with six or seven per group. And the conversations lasted about an hour. And the mean reported age of these participants was about 26, with a little less than a third of them being female, and a majority, about 60%, being white. And participants reported using marijuana on average 5 days a week. And as noted, given the fast-changing legal landscape, it's important to note that these data were collected in Rhode Island in 2015 and 2016, when marijuana was decriminalized but still considered illegal. And we followed an open coding process by two coders using thematic analysis to reach thematic saturation. And we identified three main themes in our analysis, and I'll go through each one of them. And the first one was marijuana purchasing attributes, and these included factors such as purchasing frequency, so how often people are buying, and results ranged from every day to a couple times a week to every week and about once a month. Examining schedule of purchase, participants reported largely having a regular purchasing schedule. A lot of participants reported waiting till they were completely out before purchasing marijuana. Looking at the amount of purchase, there was quite a range in how much people were buying, from an eighth to a quarter to an ounce. Quite a few participants also reported buying a 20, which is buying marijuana for $20, which gets you about 1.7 grams. We also found information relevant to the effects of these purchasing behaviors, and participated indicated that whenever they buy in bigger amounts that they find that they smoked more, and when they don't have access to marijuana that they did what they called a tolerance test to see how long they could go without smoking. Secondly, there were several factors that affected purchasing decisions, including cost, availability, with a large majority of our participants reporting easy access to marijuana. Purchase was also dependent on their financial circumstances, which makes sense. And interestingly, living situations with when they lived with their friends, they were buying more compared to when they lived with their families. Interestingly, legal consequences were not a major concern for our participants, with participants saying that it's not really a concern even if I get pulled over, and another participant saying that it's just certain people that the cops are after. Two other factors that affected these decisions were the quality of purchase, or the quality of marijuana, excuse me, but not the strain, as well as if there were holidays like 420s and birthdays. And lastly, there was factors that affected how much value they set on these marijuana, including cost and rate. There was largely consistent cost for marijuana, about $15 for a gram, $40 for an eighth, and $60 to $80 for a quarter. Factors that affected cost included if you knew your dealer, the area that you were living in, and prices apparently went way down after it was decriminalized, which makes sense. And as I said, when prices went up, people reported driving even far distances to go get cheaper marijuana. And if they said if their dealer was giving them, you know, a very expensive price, that they would just laugh in their face and walk away. And these have different implications that I'm willing that we can discuss. And importantly and interestingly for me, we asked about ways they save money in buying marijuana. And a lot of people consistently reported that buying in bulk was one way in a consistent way of saving money, that it's always cheaper the more you buy. Now, so these results indicate that marijuana purchasing behaviors vary to some extent across marijuana users and are affected by numerous external factors, including the quality, convenience, availability, living situations. Like I said, marijuana is now legal in Massachusetts, which is a neighboring state to Rhode Island, in a short drive away. So these purchasing behaviors may have changed since, but we think these results are still applicable to a large majority of the United States. And these data may be particularly useful for behavioral economic research, wherein costs and other factors are used to assess marijuana demand by setting, you know, availability and other constraints. And we think these results may also inform future research regarding potential targets for treatment and policy interventions, such as prices for legal marijuana or capping discounts for buying in bulk, if that's associated with some unintended consequences of increasing use. And we also think it's important to consider in future research how these results may vary across different contexts, different states, different cities, and importantly, in different demographic groups, because there was some homogeneity in our group with a large majority of our participants being white men. So I'm excited for that future. Yeah, that's the project.
Awesome. That's super cool. Yeah, we've had a few conversations here recently about cannabis policy, and I think this is particularly kind of relevant to that. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about how you see this kind of informing that. I know you talked a little bit about price caps and things like that. I was wondering a little bit if you have any thoughts about how that might come to life.
It's interesting because the legalities are just so different in different areas, right? Like I'm currently in Florida analyzing data that was collected a few years ago in Rhode Island. So if you walk down the street from where I live, there's new dispensaries opening up, and we go in every now and again just to see what's on the market. And the amount of discounts they offer is really just, you know, if you're on the market for it, is really hard to say no to. So I think one implication, as I mentioned, about capping these discounts would be an important thing to consider for policy interventions. If, you know, you're saying here's an ounce or here's, you know, a pound of marijuana and you get a XYZ discount, it's hard for them to say no. So And as I said, also these legal concerns are not a major concern for these individuals. So they're just taking as much as they can, as long as they're saving money. So the capping of discounts, I think, might be an important consideration in these policy interventions. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Nia. That's really cool work with some very specific policy implications, and look forward to seeing your poster at CPA and getting some look at some data. And thanks so much for coming on.
Next, we have Hallie Jordan joining us. Hallie is a fifth year doctoral candidate in counseling psychology, working with Dr. Michael Madsen at the University of Southern Mississippi, and a current pre-doctoral intern at the Southeast Louisiana Veterans Healthcare System in New Orleans. Her poster title is Psychometric Validation of the Protective Drinking Practices Scale and a National Sample of Students. Hallie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here on The Addiction Psychologist.
All right, why don't you tell us a little bit about your poster?
I would love to. Before I dive in, I would like to thank my co-authors, Dr. Kim Colvin, Esther Kim, Dr. Jessica Martin, and Dr. Michael Madsen. It's been a great team to work with, and hopefully we'll continue this research group moving forward. But in this specific study, we wanted to further evaluate the quality and usefulness of a new measure for protective behavioral strategy use. So protective behavioral strategies, or PBS, are harm reduction behaviors that people can use while drinking to help mitigate the experience of alcohol-related problems. So basically, instead of taking an abstinence-only approach to helping people minimize harms from alcohol use, this approach really helps people think of less risky ways they can drink, acknowledging that alcohol consumption is a behavior that many people do want to continue engaging in. So for example, you know, coordinating a designated driver might be one example of using PBS, as would spacing drinks over time or avoiding hard liquor and instead sticking to beer or wine. There are several measures of PBS that are psychometrically sound, so basically meaning they have demonstrated evidence of reliably and validly assessing PBS use. However, some researchers have found that these measures tend to function differently, especially when we're looking at different groups of students. So there's a body of research showing that these existing measures often function differently for white and African American college students. So to address this, our research group collected a mass of items assessing PBS use and then developed the Protective Drinking Practices Scale, or the PDPS, in 2020 using item response theory. So the PDPS is a 20-item measure of PBS use that the group found to function equivalently across white and African American college students in the initial sample. So then what this project really sought to do was to extend that work to test the PDPS in a different sample to see if some of that equivalency would hold up. So specifically, we wanted to evaluate the factor structure of the PDPS. So would it have a single factor like it did in the original study? Or would there be multiple factors or subscales like many other measures of PBS have, as well as see if the items function similarly between those groups, like it did in the original sample, test convergent validity. So do students' scores on the PDPS correlate with other alcohol-related measures as expected, and test some potential shorter versions of the measure. You know, 20 items is brief, but you know, there's always potential to be briefer. So we wanted to see what we could find there. We recruited a sample, a national sample, using Amazon's MTurk to really try and expand geographic diversity. The original sample was collected at primarily one university. So we wanted to see if we could get a better United States representation. Ultimately, we had 684 traditional age, so 18 to 25 year old undergrad college students who had to report past 30-day alcohol consumption. And at the time of data collection, since it was pre-COVID, primarily in-person attendance at a college or university in the United States. And what we found was that the PDPS did in fact function the same way in this sample as it did in the original development sample, which shows us some evidence that it seems to be functioning in a reliable or consistent way, regardless of sample characteristics, which is really promising when we consider using the PDPS as a potentially more reliable measure of PBS, regardless of geographic or demographic diversity. We also confirmed a single factor structure, which essentially means that all of the PBS items were assessing a very similar behavior rather than separate types of behaviors or separate categories of PBS that might load on different subscales. We also found that there was a strong correlation between the PDPS and another measure of PBS use, the PBSS20, which supports convergent validity, so giving us some evidence that we're accurately tapping into the construct we're measuring. And finally, we generated 5 potential 3-item short forms that also had strong psychometric properties. So this is really exciting that we generated these short form options and that there were only 3 items still with high evidence of reliability at alphas and 0.9 and above, because they could potentially facilitate quicker, less burdensome brief assessment of PBS in future research. So, you know, incorporating them in study designs that use daily diaries where, you know, people are asked to provide a lot of data on a regular basis, asking them 3 questions rather than 20 reduces participant burden in a huge way. There were certainly limitations that we hope to address in future research, including the MTurk sample, a strong geographic but not necessarily demographic diversity, and the self-report of alcohol use behaviors. So in the future, we do plan to test the PDPS in samples that are more specifically diverse on various demographic factors, so broadening beyond geographic diversity, but thinking about how we can ensure greater diversity of factors like racial identity to evaluate whether the PDPS truly is a more culturally equivalent measure of PBS use. But overall, this study really helps expand our assessment of PBS with a psychometrically sound single factor measure that shows some promise for use with diverse groups of college students.
Really exciting, such an important construct, because we know manner of drinking plays such a huge role in how quickly someone gets drunk and in the problems that they experience. Could you tell me what the main ways that this measure differs from, you know, the original protective behavioral strategies measures that do already exist?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So thinking kind of structurally, the original PBSS, which has been recently updated to the PBSS20, has multiple scales. So I would say that's probably one of the biggest structural differences between the PDPS and the original measures. So in some of the original assessments, we've got different subscales like manner of drinking PBS, serious harm reduction PBS. So evaluating how the behaviors are different in terms of, are they directly related to one's intake of alcohol, or are the behaviors things that people do while drinking but don't actually have anything to do with changing their consumption? And so that was really interesting that with the PDPS, we didn't really see that there were these clusters of items falling together in terms of what types of behaviors they were. And the items that the research group drew on for the initial development came from several different measures of PBS, including some of the original measures, as well as some additional items of behaviors that had sort of been collected over time through other research projects and clinical interactions. And so it will be really interesting to see, you know, as we continue to test and use the PDPS, whether that single factor structure continues to hold true, or, you know, whether there are truly some differences in how different types of protective behavioral strategies impact different alcohol-related outcomes.
Awesome. Thanks, Hallie.
Thank you.
So next we have Dr. Ginny Teeters, who is a licensed clinical psychologist who received her PhD from the University of Memphis in 2017. And she is currently in her 4th year as an assistant professor at Western Kentucky University. And her poster is titled, "A Mobile Phone-Based Intervention is Associated with Reductions in Driving After Cannabis Use Among Near Daily Cannabis Users." Welcome, Ginny.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm was so excited to win this registration award, and I'm really excited to tell you guys about this project.
Yeah, we're excited to have you, and congratulations. And like I said before we started recording, always good to have a former Habit Labber on. So can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so growing up, most of us were exposed to a lot of anti-drunk driving campaigns, advertisements, billboards, education programs, and we were really taught that driving after drinking is dangerous and can result in a lot of different consequences. But I want you to think about how many similar campaigns, ads, education programs you saw related to drugged driving. What about driving after cannabis use? So personally, I was never educated about the risks of driving after drug use and never really heard anything about the potential consequences of driving after cannabis use. Unfortunately, the lack of education and awareness of the risks, along with a lot of really permissive attitudes towards driving after cannabis use, has led to really high rates of driving after cannabis use, and particularly among young adults, ages 18 to 25. So the research on this topic has shown that a lot of cannabis users in this age group believe there's little to no risk of driving after use. And some even report that their driving is improved after use. So that's what I've found with participants in my own research studies, that they actually are very open about saying that. So it's already a problem in the United States, and thinking about the increase in states legalizing cannabis for recreational and medical use, more people are likely to drive after use, and there's going to be an even greater public health risk. We need to be really proactive about preventing future driving after cannabis use and intervening to reduce the level of risk for people who are already driving after use. So that's a topic of research in my lab at Western Kentucky University, the Technology Enhancing Community Health, or Tech Lab. And we're approaching this problem from a brief intervention framework. So years of research have shown that brief substance use interventions that include personalized feedback delivered in motivational interviewing style can result in reductions in frequency of substance use and the number of substance-related problems associated with use. And when you look at the research comparing in-person counselor-delivered brief interventions to remotely delivered feedback-only interventions, you see that while both are effective, in-person interventions tend to have slightly larger effects that last for a longer amount of time. But it takes a lot of resources to train interventionists to deliver in-person brief intervention sessions to every substance user age 18 to 25. And very few substance users in this age group seek out and attend these in-person interventions. So for this reason, it's really imperative that we develop interventions that are highly accessible and a low burden to the individual, but that still can lead to long-lasting behavior change. So to bridge the gap between in-person counselor-delivered brief interventions and 100% automated feedback-only interventions, my lab has developed a mobile-based brief intervention with personalized feedback and motivational interviewing style text messaging aimed at reducing substance-impaired driving. So that brings us to the study presented in our CPA poster. We examine the efficacy of this intervention in a sample of near-daily cannabis users, and that's cannabis users who use on 20 or more days per month. So in this randomized controlled trial, eligible participants were randomized to one of three conditions: the personalized feedback plus motivational interviewing text messaging condition, a substance use information condition, which was our control group and consisted of really generic information about substance use and substance impaired driving. And then we also included a personalized feedback only condition in order to parse out the importance of those motivational interviewing text messages. So all participants completed outcome measures 3 months after the intervention. We used generalized linear mixed modeling, which is a longitudinal data analysis technique, to analyze our outcome of interest, which was the change in driving after cannabis use over time. And we found that near daily cannabis users in that personalized feedback plus motivational interviewing text condition significantly reduced their number of times driving after cannabis use from baseline to 3 month follow-up, while participants in the feedback only condition didn't change their number of times driving after use. And participants in that control group showed slight non-significant decreases in driving over time. So we were really excited about these findings. They provide preliminary support for at least the short-term efficacy of this intervention. And we're really hoping in the future to be able to replicate and extend these findings.
That's awesome. I think that's such an interesting concept that it's so common, but we don't even think about it as much, right? And you're talking about the ad campaigns and things like that. So I'm really curious what you think the next steps are for some of this work that you're doing here.
Yeah, so I'm really hoping this sample that we were able to recruit for this study was about 97 cannabis users. And I'm really hoping to be able to recruit a larger sample. And importantly, I really want to test the efficacy of this among non-college cannabis users. So a lot of brief intervention work and then my past work has been looking at college students, which are a high-risk group. But as far as the latest data on cannabis use, non-college peers in the same age group have higher rates of cannabis use and problems. So I think extending the intervention work to a community sample is going to be really important. So I've applied for some grant funding and I really hope to be able to expand this to a community sample and also look at a longer follow-up period.
Well, fingers crossed for your submissions, and thank you so much for joining us. This is such important work and we're always happy to have some Habit Labber join us.
Right.
Of course. Thank you guys so much.
Next, we have Dr. Emily Hennessy, who is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and an associate director of biostatistics at the Recovery Research Institute. Her poster is Parents and Family Mechanisms of Social Recovery Capital for Youth Recovery. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to talk about my poster. And before I get started, I do want to thank my co-authors on this poster, Jordan Drinsky, Hazel Simpson, and Angela Nash. And I also need to thank my funding support from NIAAA under a KO1 award. And Angela Nash actually received funding to conduct the study as well. So we need to thank the Knapp Foundation and Sigma Theta Tau for their funding support for this study. The recovery process for adolescents with a substance use disorder is complicated, and it typically takes them multiple tries to successfully recover and make it through that whole process. Something that is really important to that process is how many supports and resources they have, also known as recovery capital. And so essentially that's just this basic idea of what are the internal supports that they have in terms of motivation for recovery, life goals, things that they're looking forward to. And what are the contextual supports for recovery? So thinking about their friend and their family supports, as well as kind of the larger contextual environment, you know, what are some of the recovery supports that are available in their community, if any? So those are kind of all different pieces of recovery capital. And something we know that is really effective for youth in recovery is having sober and supportive peers and social recovery capital. And we also know that parents are a big part of that process in terms of having family social recovery capital. But a lot of previous research, while it identifies social recovery capital as important, it doesn't actually dig into what some of those mechanisms of social recovery capital are. It doesn't actually dig into how parents necessarily show their support for their youth in recovery or what that looks like on a day-to-day basis. And so this poster examines that process from parents who experienced having a child go through a recovery process. So this is secondary data analysis from a qualitative ethnographic study. It was a purposive sampling where youth who had previously attended a alternative peer group were recruited to talk about their experiences. They're called alumni of this alternative peer group, which is a group for youth that are in recovery, provides sober, fun supports for them, as well as mentoring in the recovery process. So these youth were recruited, and then their parents were also recruited to talk about their experience while their youth were back in the program. And so for this analysis, we just looked at interview data from the parents that were recruited for the study. So we analyzed focus groups that were conducted with five moms and five dads of youth that had gone through this program. really just looking for how they talked about their child's recovery within the framework of recovery capital. And so these interviews were coded using content analysis from a qualitative perspective. So we read through the interviews, looking for these themes, looking for instances of primarily social recovery capital. And as we identified those themes, we tried to tease out what were some potential mechanisms of what those themes were that the parents talked about. What did they talk about as ways they supported their child in recovery? And what did they talk about that process? And how did they reflect on that process? And so what we ended up with was a pretty robust picture of how parents who had youth who had successfully recovered, what they did to support that, and how they also changed at that time. And so a lot of that was actually linked to how they participated in the alternative peer group. And so I'll give a little bit of background now on the alternative peer group so the mechanisms can become a little bit clearer. But essentially, an alternative peer group involves youth and their parents in activities to engage them in learning how to be supportive of each other in this process, as well as to learn some new skills. And so for parents specifically, they have a moms and dads group where moms and dads can get together, talk about their challenges, learn about ways that they can parent a child who's in recovery. They have multi-family group where families, so the entire family or family members of youth that are part of the alternative peer group will get together and talk through issues that they're going through. The alternative peer group has social events for the youth to attend, but it also has some that the parents can attend and that parents are encouraged to attend to kind of build that relational capacity with their child again. And then parents are also encouraged to work through some sort of 12-step process. So really to think about their role in their child's recovery and how they can contribute to it and how they can improve their reactions to things that are going on with their child. And so throughout all these steps, if parents choose to participate in them, these parents that were interviewed spoke about the changes that occurred as a result of that participation. And they also really talked about how they had to be open and willing to do that. And so one of the primary themes that we identified in these focus groups was of parents learning and changing. And so parents had to be willing and open to learn and change, and it was not comfortable. Moms and dads spoke about the feeling of having to expose themselves in these settings and really, really be honest about their feelings and their reflections, and that it was difficult, but looking back, they're really glad that they were able to make that change. Another theme that came out was locus of control transitions. And so because they're parents of adolescents are trying to get their own independence, trying to be their own people. And so there's going to be a natural kind of shift in who is controlling a situation, who kind of has the power to change a situation. And for parents, that can be difficult enough if their child isn't in recovery. But for a parent who is trying to work through their child's recovery with them, figuring out that balance of when to step in and give a structured environment and when to hold back can be very tricky. And so the alternative peer group provided them with some tools about how to go about doing that in a way that helped their child's recovery and then also helped them work through the situation. And so what we found is as parents were engaging in these activities, they were learning these things, they were provided with social support from the alternative peer group. And they were building their own internal strength, but they were also building their relationship with their child and better understanding the process that their child was going through as a member of the alternative peer group and as someone who's in recovery. And so as a result of this, the third thing we found was really this change in the family where it became a supportive and structured family environment for the youth in terms of their recovery capital. And so parents really felt supported as being parents. They learned these new skills. They were able to change their home environment, and they talked about having this new kind of real relationship with their child where they could have arguments and be mad at each other and know that at the end of the day, their relationship was still strong and that the child wouldn't necessarily go back to using substances because of an argument or a fight. And so what we found really was through this alternative peer group process, parents, because of their willingness to change, also received supports and also were able to work through this process as a family unit and really become something stronger out of it. And so in conclusion, there were a few kind of overall generic findings that we wanted to share with folks listening to this. And really it's that, oftentimes parents in these situations come in feeling a little bit defensive and they feel some stigma and negative emotions because they feel like it's their fault. Like they should have prevented their child from being in this situation, or they could have handled it better. And all the parents spoke about those feelings, and then realizing as they engage with their child, as they engage with the alternative peer group process, that actually now was a chance for them to learn how to cope with the situation, and it wasn't their fault, and they were provided with tools on how to do so. And so what's really exciting about the alternative peer groups is that for families that can do this and can be involved, it seems to be a mechanism for creating this social recovery capital that the parents and the youth are getting. And so they're both kind of building into the recovery process together.
Awesome. Thank you. That's very, very exciting work. And what do you think are kind of your next steps with this? How can you bring these results to life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, it's funny because as a researcher, we're going in and finding these themes. And I feel like that this is what the alternative peer group tells families, right? It says, this is what we're going to do, but they don't necessarily have the evidence base behind them in the way that we've been able to kind of pull out from these interviews. And so, you know, one thing we'd really like to do is to share this information and kind of an infographic with the sites to say, like, this is kind of evidence that you can use to support family involvement, to kind of get them going and excited. And I think as well for other alternative peer groups that are folks who are interested in starting them, this kind of provides a template for thinking about the child as part of the family unit and building their recovery capital through the family with all these kind of steps. And so really being mindful of, you can have an alternative peer group that has fun activities for youth, but if you're not doing the other pieces to build in not these other environmental supports that are already part of their lives, it's going to be tricky to kind of gain traction.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Emily. That's very interesting.
Thank you.
All right. Well, next we're going to have Marie O'Hanrahan, who is a health psychology doctoral candidate in the Addictions Research Group at the University of South Wales. It's also several hours later. It's well into the evening there. So thanks for joining us so late. And her poster is titled Factors Predicting Substance Use Relapse, Service Providers' Perceptions. So welcome, Marie.
Hello. Hi. Yeah. Thanks for having me. Delighted to be on.
Yeah. Well, we're really glad to see that CPA has gone international. And wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your poster.
Yes, certainly. So my overall research aims to identify what factors predict relapse. So within recovery support services, relapse can be quite a setback for individuals' recovery, and it often results in dropout from these services. So to identify whether a relapse may occur would greatly assist in establishing the appropriate support needed to manage or prevent relapse. So with this specific study, I interviewed service providers who work directly with individuals in recovery to obtain their views and professional experiences of what predicts relapse. And from that, five key themes of relapse predictors emerged. So maladaptive coping is a big one. Returning to substance use as a coping mechanism when experiencing stressful situations or unexpected events. Relapsing to self-medicate against mental health issues such as anxiety or depression was also highlighted. So limited support then is another theme identified. This includes the lack of support from family, friends, or a close relationship in general, as some people end up being quite isolated in their recovery, mainly due to the major lifestyle change that they're undergoing. And limited support within the recovery services themselves was also a predictor. So here in South Wales, there's a great need for a multi-service approach to assist with recovery. So this would include the input of mental health services, housing, welfare, social services, the lot, but that's currently not available at this time. Behavioural changes then was another factor. So this included a noticeable decline in personal care, and the breakdown of their daily structured routines. Also, reduced engagement by pulling away from support provided indicated relapse occurrence. And the fourth theme then identified is environmental influences, particularly returning to their previous substance use environment. This could be their local area where substances were readily available and easily obtained, and areas where they may encounter others who are still using, or even those at an earlier, more chaotic stage of their recovery. Also engaging in a social group event. Here in the UK, there's often alcohol involved, wherever you know it may be. So it could be celebrating a big win in a rugby game, or even attending a funeral. So, or even you know, simply going to your grocery shop. You're greeted with slabs of alcohol as soon as you walk in. So there's a wide variety of different environmental factors involved. And readiness to change then is the final theme identified. Service providers noted that some people join support services with motivation to change, and this soon dwindles, and the fear of the recovery process, along with perceiving the return to substance use as a safe, comfortable option, take over. And then there's a select few who join recovery services as a contracted or legal requirement. So they have no self-motivation or even intention to change, and therefore a return to use is common. So those are the key findings that service providers deem as important when identifying relapse. And it certainly shed some light on the relapse process.
Wow, that's some really interesting work. And I think understanding factors that predict relapse, I think, is super crucial, considering how many people, you know, the statistics out there, I think, are like between 40 and 60% of people end up relapsing mm-hmm. within the first 90 days of engaging in recovery. And it sounded like you had a pretty nice palette, but I was wondering if you believe that there are more predictors than perhaps the ones that were identified by the practitioners that you interviewed.
Yes, certainly. Yeah, that's a good question. Along with this study, my project includes a systematic review and interviews with service users themselves. So from that research, other relapse factors alongside those that I mentioned have popped up. So an interesting one is impulsivity and the influence that can have on a potential relapse. Craving was also noted by service users as a factor involved in their relapse process.
Next, we have Dr. Frank Schwebel joining us. Frank is a postdoctoral research fellow working with Drs. Matt Pearson and Katie Wickowitz at the Center on Alcohol, Substance Use, and Addiction, known as CASA, at the University of New Mexico. His poster is titled Budding Recursive Partitioning Trees to Identify Predictors of Cannabis-Related Outcomes. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your work?
Absolutely. About 1 in 4 college students use cannabis. Many people don't experience severe problems from cannabis, but 90% of college students who use cannabis report at least one negative consequence, like having problems with friends or family, or feeling anxious or paranoid. Importantly, this age group has the highest rates of cannabis use disorder, which is associated with significant distress to the person. To develop and improve interventions, it really is important to understand what contributes to harmful cannabis use. This poster explores a wide range of factors to see which ones are the most important predictors of cannabis use, negative consequences from cannabis, and symptoms of cannabis use disorder among college students. Of course, some of this work has been done already. Some predictors include personality traits like sensation seeking and impulsivity, using cannabis to cope with negative emotions, also known as coping motives, and using specific strategies to reduce harm from cannabis use. Now, these studies only looked at a few predictors at a time because they use linear models. So we used a machine learning approach called recursive partitioning, which is also called decision tree learning or classification trees. What's important here is that this approach lets us look at many variables and find the set of variables that are most important. We looked at over 150 variables. Now, decision trees are easiest to understand when looking at them. So if you're interested, this poster and associated paper are available at mateolab.yolasite.com and on Twitter. That said, I'll do my best to explain this in words. We've probably all read an article with a flowchart that has multiple paths from an initial question about you to your quote-unquote ideal response. Now, I really like camping, and recently was reading an article with a flowchart designed to tell me what my ideal camping vehicle is. The chart has questions like, do you like camping in a tent? Then you reply yes or no, and you work your way down the chart until you reach your ideal answer. Decision tree looks very similar to one of these flowcharts. If anyone cares, the vehicle I was recommended is a Van Life Van, but I'll not be buying one of those. Now, this study was conducted by the Marijuana Outcomes Study Team and includes 7,000 college students across 10 states. In predicting whether someone used cannabis, among college students who reported the pros of cannabis to be important in their decision to use and found it fairly or very easy to obtain cannabis, over 80% had used cannabis in their lifetime. For those who thought it was fairly or very easy to obtain, thought the pros of cannabis were less important, only about 40% used cannabis. And among those who thought it was difficult to obtain cannabis, less than 30% had ever used cannabis. Surprising to us, we found only one predictor of negative cannabis-related consequences, which was number of time periods they used in a typical week. Individuals who used cannabis during four or fewer time periods during a typical week reported an average of 2.5 consequences. Individuals who reported five or more time periods during a typical week reported an average of nearly 6 consequences. It would take really just far too long to go into each of the 8 remaining models of cannabis use disorder symptoms, so I'll just provide a 10,000 foot view of the models. The most consistent predictors across our models of cannabis use disorder symptoms were negative reinforcement cannabis use motives, which includes using cannabis to cope with negative emotions and using cannabis to fit in with peers. Days of recent cannabis use during the past 30 days was the next most consistent predictor. We found that the combination of using cannabis frequently during the past month and using it to cope with negative emotions or to fit in with peers greatly increased the likelihood of reporting more symptoms of cannabis use disorder. Overall, our models could help clinicians who work with people with cannabis use disorder. In particular, clinicians can discuss some of these factors with their clients to see if they may be contributing to some of their problems, and then perhaps they could become treatment targets in order to help improve people's lives. Future work is needed to see if these same factors are important in other groups like older adults or people from around the world. Regardless, further exploratory work will be helpful to identify variables that might predict cannabis use disorder symptoms.
Awesome. That's very interesting. And it's a statistical approach that I'm less familiar with, but I think your overview actually provided, you know, enough information for me to adequately understand. So thank you for that, Frank. And I'm wondering where do you think this is going to take you? How is this going to inform your future research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad to hear the description worked. It really is. I wish I had a picture that we could show. Obviously, it doesn't work in a podcast. I would say the nature of the work is very exploratory. And the way these model works, replication isn't something you're really looking for. I think looking at this in other samples to see if these are really consistent predictors is going to be important. Or perhaps, you know, it's really that these predictors primarily apply to college students. And then hopefully eventually as we can build up more and more evidence about these predictors that it can be used to design prevention and intervention efforts.
Awesome. Thanks, Frank.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Next, we have Thalia Sullivan, who is a second-year clinical psychology PhD student working with Dr. Meredith Ginley in the Prevention, Education, and Treatment of Addiction Learning Lab at East Tennessee State University. And she's going to be talking about her poster, which is titled Validation of the Daily Sessions, Frequency, Age of Onset, and Quantity of Cannabis Use Inventory Among an Illicit Cannabis Using Population. Welcome, Thalia.
Hi, Samuel and Noah. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to share my research.
We're really excited to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your poster?
Yeah, of course. So this poster was done in collaboration with my advisor, Dr. Meredith Ginley, and my colleagues, Rochelle Kromosh and Hannah Mitchell, who are also in ETSU's clinical psychology doctoral program. Our poster focuses on validating the daily sessions, frequency, age of onset, and quantity of cannabis use inventory, also known as the DFAQCU for short. Now, the DFAQCU has a total of 39 items. However, only 22 of those are core items and the rest are additional screening items. The DFAQCU assesses daily sessions, frequency of cannabis use, age of onset of cannabis use, and quantity of marijuana, concentrates, and edibles consumed. Cutler and Spradlin, the original developers of the measure, established preliminary psychometric properties in a population of college students using cannabis legally. Given that the DFAQCU is being increasingly referenced and used within the field, we wanted to further investigate its psychometric properties within a population of individuals using cannabis illicitly. So in particular, we evaluated the DFAQCU's component structure, reliability, and convergent and divergent validity. Our sample consisted of 410 participants recruited from an undergraduate subject pool in a state where cannabis is illegal, with 41% of them indicating lifetime cannabis use. Participants' mean age was approximately 21 years old, and 70% of our sample was female, and 83% self-identified as Caucasian. In addition to participants completing the DFAQCU, they completed the drug use disorders identification test, which was used to establish convergent validity, and the video gaming dependency scale, which was used to establish divergent validity. Now, unlike Cutler and Spradlin, who ran an exploratory factor analysis, we opted to run a principal components analysis as we felt that cannabis consumption can be directly measured, and we know the components that underlie it, unlike other constructs such as, let's say, emotion regulation or prejudice. So we ran a principal components analysis with no rotation at first and noticed that items 20 and 27 were exhibiting singularity or were highly correlated, which was recognized by a positive definite error, so we opted to take both of those items out. Following, we ran another principal components analysis, again with no extraction, and examined the eigenvalues and scree plot, which suggested extracting 5 components. However, this solution had numerous cross-loadings, as well as some items not loading at all. Extracting 4 components was instead found to be the best solution and resulted in only 1 item cross-loading. The results failed to support Cutler and Spradlin's original 6-factor structure of the DFAQCU within an illicit substance using population, and instead a 4-component structure was established. Moreover, Kronbach reliability analyses of the 4 components showed good to excellent internal consistency, which were higher than the original 6-factor structure reliabilities. This indicated that the set of items within each component group were closely related and likely asking questions about similar topics. Bivariate correlations indicated that components 1, 2, and 3 demonstrated medium to large convergent validity with the Duddit total score, suggesting that those components do in fact measure the same construct, which in this case is substance use. However, convergent validity for component 4 could not be established, warranting future research. All factors were divergent from the video gaming dependency scale, and this means that the components of the DFAQCU measure a construct that theoretically should not be highly related to video gaming dependency, and in fact, it was not. Also notably, divergent validity failed to be established with the original 6-factor structure. So our results are promising and warrant future research to attempt to confirm the 4-component structure and establish that the DFAQCU is in fact a psychometrically sound inventory for measuring cannabis consumption within research populations. Moreover, previous research has documented that frequency, age of onset, and quantity of cannabis use often result in mental health comorbidities. Given that the DFAQCU assesses these factors, it may be a well-suited inventory for clinical settings, and future research should assess the validity of the measure within such settings. This would ultimately assist clinicians in identifying cannabis consumption-related risk factors among their patients.
Well, thank you for walking through such a complicated set of analyses, right? It's always tough to be able to do that. So I think you did it really, really well. So, also shout out to my daughter, April, who is joining us for the podcast currently. She doesn't make an appearance all the time, so I'm glad she could make it today. So why do you think the measure performed differently in an illicit versus licit using sample?
Yeah, I was actually wondering that question too. given that our sample was engaging in illegal cannabis consumption, there may be a third variable related to general risk-taking, such as impulsivity, that we didn't account for in our model, and it may be driving the relations between the items. And I think the next step for either myself or other researchers is to not only attempt to replicate the four component structure in an illicit cannabis using population, but to also assess for a third variable that may be accounting for some unmeasured variance.
Awesome. Thank you, Thalia. That was really interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.